Welcome to The Political Nomad. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. Thanks for listening. This week, we're getting the second half of my conversation with the host of the We Are Libertarians podcast, Chris Spangle. I really enjoyed talking with Chris. I think you'll enjoy this half of our conversation as well. Here's part two.
Well, you sort of alluded to this, but in your opinion, what role should politics play in our lives in the era of COVID-19? I mean, I think your political journey and the things that you've been talking about can bring a very unique perspective on how to personally approach this crisis, especially as it's happening in an election year, and what this could all mean post-2020.
Well, I think anybody who knows exactly what to do is kind of fooling themselves, but I think in general, we know certain rules apply. If you prohibit something, prohibition always fails. That's just a general principle. And so when you prohibit alcohol, or you prohibit drugs, or you prohibit travel, or you prohibit something, you create bad incentives, you create more bad actors, you create unintended consequences that you didn't want to take place in the first place. You prohibit alcohol, so you end up with NASCAR and Al Capone. So, you know, there's there can be unintended good and bad consequences from things. And so travel is a fundamental human right, and there is no government that has the legitimate authority to stop you from traveling. There is no government that has the legitimate authority to stop commerce from taking place. Business licensing, for instance, is just a way for them to control our commercial behavior. Right now, if you are not a wuss, you can go open your business. You're just not going to because you don't want to lose your business license or your corporation status or whatever the duopoly of mobsters has over you. You don't want to lose that because they have force, right? And force is the key component of it. Without force, without police officers showing up to your door to arrest you, politicians are just people with bad opinions that we can ignore and not listen to. But because there is inherent force in everything, people behave a certain way, but they resent it. And so you see, as we ask police officers to do more and more in society, you see more and more hatred towards police officers. And then you get the back the blue, and it creates these fake divisions in society when realistically, if everything just happened organically, you wouldn't have that. You got to back the blue. No, I'm blue. I'm Black Lives Matter. You know, you don't have those fake divisions in society. The reality is most people don't care if their cousin who is gay gets married to another man. They don't want the government to be involved in it. And they feel that if the government is going to speak one way or the other, I need to get involved in this because if they're going to force me to live this way, I need to force them to live a certain way. I've got to force gay people to do this or not do this because they're going to force my gay cake shop or whatever to do something. So you end up creating bad incentives, bad unintended consequences, and you make bad actors out of people. So, you know, 2 weeks ago they're telling us not to wear masks. Now there's Philly cops beating the hell out of a man for not wearing a mask on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that video. Right. It took 1 week to go from don't wear a mask to if you get on this bus without a mask on, we're going to physically violate you. We're going to commit battery. If we didn't have on this costume, then they would go to jail for battery. Well,
there were like 8 police officers trying to get one guy off a bus.
Right. And so
and it happened to be African American. I mean, I did notice that.
So the reality is that is the most shared thing that I have ever put online. And it's because people are going, what's wrong here? What's happening? And my message is the ability to force people to do things creates just petty tyranny. Those guys are tyrannical. The peaceful solution is to have a mask in your back pocket and go, here's a mask. Instead, they go, we don't care why you don't have a mask. We don't know. Maybe this guy can't afford a mask. Maybe it's impossible to get a mask because a week earlier, the governments at all levels were saying don't buy masks. You know, I've been trying to buy masks for my mom, who is a nurse in an ICU ward. It's nearly impossible. I mean, it's really hard. And so now we're going to tell everybody in the world to wear masks. So the government has artificially created a ton of demand and there's no supply. And then we're going to beat you up if you don't do what we say. And so, you know, it is not lost on me that what is an essential business to Eric Holcomb in Indiana is a business that has a really good lobbyist. And what is a non-essential business is a business that is not employing a lobbyist and has a lot of poor people in it. And so the reality is that the government, while I think people should be staying home, and I believe that this is real, and I believe that there would be economic consequences because it's a pandemic. If you study history, when there's a pandemic, behavior changes. People, regardless of government, are not going to go to restaurants. They're not going to go to stores. They're going to wear masks. They're going to change their behavior. If you inform people and tell adults the truth, they will decide for themselves what is best. They will employ rational self-interest. So the reason that most people are not going to the store right now and the reason most people are staying indoors is not because the government is telling them not to. They're not going because they want to protect themselves and their family.
Yeah.
You don't stop at a stop sign because the government tells you to stop at a stop sign. You stop at that stop sign because you don't want to plow into somebody or be plowed into. So if the government was just more honest with us and told us exactly what was happening or to the best of our ability, that's why I find the whole Fire Fauci movement crazy, because this is the one person who's telling us the truth about what's going on, and we want to fire him because we don't like what he's saying. The other part of it is, you know, Donald Trump is the president. He is the government. He sent me a letter. He sent me a postcard that says President Trump's guidelines from the CDC.
Yeah, I got that too.
Yeah, and it has his name on it. And then he releases these, and all the governors start following suit and implementing what Donald Trump said they ought to do. Well, now that everyone's mad about that in his circle, he's blaming the guy who doesn't work for the CDC and is a low-level bureaucrat. So your argument, Donald, is that you were so feeble-minded that you got bamboozled by a low-level low-level bureaucrat.
Right. Like,
yeah. Not great leadership. So it's.
Hey, have you gotten your campaign check yet with his name on it yet from the U.S. Treasury?
No, I have not gotten my letter. So if you're just honest with people and you tell them what to do, businesses were voluntarily shutting down. We canceled at great economic pain for us and our partners. We canceled a lot of events. The NBA and the NCAA cost billions of dollars for themselves and their partners by voluntarily shutting down. They were doing the right thing. And, you know, the reality is there were always going to be bad actors. But are the bad actors the three people showing up to a restaurant if they're still open currently? Let's say there are still restaurants and there's still dining room service. How many people are really showing up to that? A day, right? Like 2-3 customers a day. Businesses were always going to lay people off. I think the right just does a disservice and lies to people and says there wasn't going to be economic pain. Smithfield up in South Dakota proves that a business was always going to have to shut down because their workers got sick. It would have been to pretend that this isn't real and to put your head in the sand is Pollyanna thinking that if I ignore my problems, they'll go away. Well, biology has something different here. But the reality is that is society better served by closing everything but Walmart down, and you're funneling everybody in a zip code into 2 big box stores, and those are the only things that are open? How is that a better solution? And then you're gonna close down the seed section because the local the well-connected person in your town says, hey, I own a paint store, I can't be open, why does Walmart get to sell paint? So you close down the paint section, and then all of a sudden the money disappears from your local community and goes online. How does that benefit? So the reality is we have to learn to start trusting our neighbors more, and I know that that's hard to do because we see the idiots on the beach, but we're overly concerned with what other people are doing. Abdul just did a poll, and only 32% of people are actually worried about their own safety with everything. They're more worried about their neighbors and what they're up to. And that has gone from, you know, we need to stand 6 feet apart from each other and it won't infect us, to now, if you don't stay in your home, you're going to kill me and my family. I had some family on a walk the other night, and they're being screamed at by an old man in the neighborhood. How dare you? Well, you can't lock people in their houses and close the parks down and tell them they can't go walking and they can't like, it just doesn't work like that. So it's...
Yeah, I feel like there have been crazy levels of extremes on the yes. during this whole thing, that it's either stay in your home, do not leave under, you know, penalty of law, for the fact that I will call the law on you, to the, this thing's fake, I'm fine, I'm going to go anywhere and everywhere I want because I can.
Because you have attention drifting towards what the government says. And so everybody is obsessed with what Trump and the governors are saying. And so nobody is – this country didn't take this – you know, and let's say China and Hu were honest, right? Like, who amongst us was going to pay attention to begin with, right? Like, I didn't take any of this seriously until Joe Rogan did a podcast with an epidemiologist three weeks ago.
Me too, yeah.
And so the reality is that if you have a government and you have a central state, then all of those reporters – are lazy, and there's not enough resources to cover things, and so they just look at the government and go, tell us what we think. And so everyone is basing their arguments around the two-party system, as opposed to a proliferated network where spontaneous order would mean that people will generally get it right. When you look at what's going on in the blogosphere or podcasts, people with podcasts and blogs are generally pretty responsible, right? Like, my first concern through all of this is, will I share information that could get someone in my audience killed? That is my number one concern. It's not saying something that could hurt someone. So if it is a matter of, and not everybody does that, but by and large, every media, podcast, blog, whatever, they all just kind of focus on the human element and what's going on and what's right or wrong, and then they get less attention because everybody's watching CNN and Fox News and the fake WWE match, and we're all obsessed over what this petty old man is interested in fighting about that day.
Yeah. So how do you see this playing out in the realm of the 2020 election? I mean, Republicans are obviously stuck with Trump. And Democrats are stuck with Biden. You know, President Obama, you know, did the courageous thing and waited until everyone was out to finally endorse his former vice president. I mean, and God bless him. Joe Biden doesn't look like he can connect three words together at this point. Things honestly don't look like they're going to change, but, you know, it's like our country is... biology, to a degree, is begging for a change. And, you know, I'm not buying into this whole humanity is a virus thing, but I do take notice that things are – there are some silver linings about the pandemic from a nature perspective. From a – you know, everyone was all about, you know, on – climate change, it was, you know, it was divided into two camps, either full on Greta Thunberg or, you know, well, she's just an angry little girl. Right. And it's like nature said, give me a second. We'll take care of this for a little bit, you know.
Here's some dolphins in Venice.
Yeah, which I guess that was proven to be a hoax, that they've always been there. But I guess I look at this and it seems like 2020 is begging for a change in whether that's the way that we approach government, the way that we, and I'm talking about leadership. I'm not saying that we, you know, burn down the system, but I'm just talking about the way that whether we approach the government, the way that we approach climate issues, the way that we approach healthcare, the way that we approach many things that we have taken for granted or used as a way to take people for granted, that I mean a lot of people are finally realizing I can do this from home. Now maybe they don't want to after a pandemic, but I think a lot of businesses can are able to figure out that, hey, a lot of stuff can still take place not in a corporate atmosphere. You know, it's like
if they realize that productivity drops off 5%, then they go, why am I paying rent? Why have a landlord? You know, I mean, yeah. If you're commercial real estate, you're hoping everybody's not working and watching Netflix.
Well, exactly. But I mean, it's from some articles I've seen, it seems as productivity has actually gone up from people who are working from home, despite all the day drinking and potential, you know, binge watching of stuff. But I mean, instead of forcing people to change via government regulation, we're seeing changes, some positive changes, again, from I guess not from an economic perspective, mind you, because obviously the economy is suffering, but I'm talking about just from the way that whether we can approach things from instead of forcing like climate change issues. I mean, we're kind of forced into the situation now, but nothing's been cut.
Well,
you know, so, regulations haven't changed.
Yeah, so you have
we're starting to see some improvements, and so it's just like, you know, is it possible that we could take this opportunity to potentially implement good changes, or do we see people taking 2020 and taking things to the extremes and trying to force things on people?
Well, yes. The answer is yes.
Okay.
The reality is that this is an epical event that completely changes so many different things in so many ways. And so I think if you want to look at who's going to win the 2020 election, you have to dig deeper. You have to think about – I never make the error, and I think a lot of people go, well, because I feel that way or I think that way, nobody else thinks that way. I tend to think that the way that I think or the way that I feel about something or the way that I react to something is probably indicative of a lot of people. And then I also take the next step of going, not everyone's like me, so I need to have more diversity of friendships. So I call my friend Miss Pat and I go, what are you thinking about this? And we talk it over, and she's, you know, she's not as scared about the pandemic because she's like, I've been poor. I don't care what the economy does. I know what it's like to be broke. I'll be fine, you know. Yeah. Versus my white friends who are just like white knuckled going, I can't handle this.
Yeah.
And so I always, that's how I always kind of start things. How do I think and feel about this? How do my friends and other people think about this? Then what's the conversation in the news? And what I generally kind of see in terms of trends is a big shift in a lot of ways. I heard the CEO of Unilever on CNBC the other day say that his social listening devices show that there has been a monumental shift in people going, if Bill Gates and experts were right about the pandemic, then maybe they're right about climate change and inequality. And so some of these bigger issues, I think, people are going to take more seriously. I think that people are going to become more socially conscious. I think as baby boomers move out of their roles, which unfortunately this may keep a lot of baby boomers kind of in the economy even longer than they need to be. Like, that's part of why, you know, I turned 18 in the middle of that downturn. I graduate high school. I graduate college right into 2008. In that downturn, and now I'm entering my earning power years, and it's another crisis. And so, like, millennials have just been kicked in the butt the entire time, and they're not able to really move up because a lot of boomers are still in the workforce. But as I think millennials start to step up into a lot of leadership roles, I think they bring a much more community conscious, empathetic viewpoint. I think they're more sensitive to social trends. They're more willing, even though I am a Christian conservative, right-leaning person, I look at it and go, if people who are homeless want to be called people who are experiencing homelessness, then I will use that phrase because I want to be sensitive to people who are going through that struggle. Whereas I think a lot of baby boomers look at it and go, I don't care how they feel or think. I'm going to call you what I want because I'm resistant to change.
Yes.
So I think this is going to be a moment when a lot of millennials – I have seen Donald Trump be very helpful in a couple things, and it is people realizing what their government can do and who, how important it is. Government is literally, your vote is literally a life or death proposition, and it has never been more clear right now. And I think that they have taken that for granted, and they're really starting to understand, I need to pay attention. I need to get involved in this. And so, you know, my numbers on my show are 5 times larger in the last month than they are from the month before, because there's just so many more people downloading some of these basic episodes about what the hell's going on, because they want to know the context of things. So I think people are going to become more conscious of social issues. And I don't mean just social issues in the way that baby boomers and their generation politically thought about it was gay marriage. Social issues of inequality, food security, and how do we get involved? I think the government is going to become more non-functional. And I think as government becomes more non-functional and not and play less and less of a role, and we kind of go, these are a bunch of squabbling children, let's get to business over here with this nonprofit, network together, let's make a bunch of NGOs and get to work, I think that's going to be have a really positive change for the country. I think that so more social conscience, more action. I think people are going to save more. I think people are going to really take a hard look at their consumeristic behavior and go, I'm taking this $1,200 and I'm saving it, or I'm paying down debt. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I have talked to several friends who have said, I cannot believe my friend who is going to spend that $1,200 at Ashley Furniture, or they're going to buy a new TV. How outrageous. So I think our
generation... That's not too different from what President Bush encouraged people to do after 9/11.
It's your patriotic duty to go spend money. I was telling my I have a girlfriend, she's 25, and she doesn't remember that stuff. And I go, it's your patriotic duty to spend money. And she didn't laugh because she didn't get it. And then I was like, oh, so here's what happened. I sent you $250 and you were supposed to go spend it. You know?
Yeah.
So this ain't my first rodeo. So yeah, I think that there is a huge change in all this stuff, and I think we're going to embody, as the millennial generation, I know you're Gen X, so you're kind of screwed, but you've known that from the beginning. I think Gen X and Gen Z are kind of a lost generation. Gen Z especially, I think you're going to see sort of a Japanese lost generation as stagflation hits. But millennials are motivated to make society different and better. And consumer culture, I think, is going to take a hit. And I think that Dave Ramsey has shown that. I think the limited earning power of millennials have shown we're willing to kill off discretionary businesses that don't fit our lifestyle. There is no generation better at sitting at home and doing nothing than millennials, because we haven't had the discretionary income to go out and do the things that we've wanted to do. And so when we look at this, we go, eh, okay, well, I guess 2 more years of this BS.
Yeah.
So I think to answer your question about the fall, I think there is part of me that is collapsitarian, that I look at this and I go, they're printing so much money, they're creating so much cash in the system that you can never take this cash that the Fed is printing out of the system without deflation. What happens in deflation? Prices fall and you get Weimar Germany or Venezuela. That can happen here, and let's not be arrogant enough to think that it couldn't. And the more you print, the less you can take out, and so inflation just becomes a bigger and bigger problem. The biggest reason we have, your grandparents and my grandparents could have a one household income. Our parents needed to have 2 working parents. Mm-hmm. The reason MLMs are so important right now to people is that they need a third income. There needs to be a side hustle, because 2 incomes isn't cutting it. Well, that's a direct result of Fed policy and Bretton Woods. And you look at the inflation rate from 72 when we went off the gold standard, and it just went. And so people are having a hard time making it. And then you add 30% unemployment, you add a dysfunctional government, you add the Bubba effect with all these guys with guns, and they're pissed off about their liberties. And then you have we're going to keep this shut down until September, and then you have these rallies, and then a white person gets killed by a cop, and then it's off to the races. So, I mean, there's the part of me that looks at this and goes, we're entering a Great Depression era with years of pain civil unrest and a lot of like really nasty times. And who knows what happens? You've got a guy who is willing to lie and say and do anything as president. He is a cult leader. He is every bit as authoritarian, in my opinion. Now, after through this crisis, I've realized what my liberal friends have been saying about this guy from the very beginning. And and the sooner the right and Republicans wake up to who this person is, the better off we're going to be, because he has bamboozled so many people. There are people who do not think that this virus is real. They think that it's a ploy by Bill Gates to gain more power. And you just go, Bill Gates is more powerful than the president already. He already has all the money in the world. He's the richest man. What else does he need? You know, the right. Incentives don't make sense again. But so then there's the other part of me that goes, you've been through two of these. It's going to be a V-like recovery. You know, Houston during Harvey had a 2-month downturn with an 80% drop in their economy, and then they come back and they're okay. We'll all be fine. This is the worst it's going to be, and people will kind of. So, what does October look like? What does November look like? What does November 1st look like? Is it that dystopian, oh crap, we're going down the toilet vision, or is it it's or is it the more stable, it's all going to be okay vision? I don't think I know, and I don't think anybody else knows. And I think
no one does. Yeah,
when you look at the actions of the Fed, when you look at what took months to debate in 2007 and 8, took weeks to implement now, and the speed with which they've tried to save the economy, I think that is a sign of terror in people who are in charge of our economy. I think, you know, the numbers are unprecedented in terms of economic downturn. I don't know that Trump is going to get the benefit of the doubt like Bush did in 2004 with the don't change horses in midstream. When you look at Eric Holcomb's approval numbers, it's 80%. Cuomo, it's 90%. 80% for the California governor. All these governors have like 80, 90% approval ratings through the last couple months. Donald Trump isn't cracking 50. And so you go, how is a guy who every day he becomes more petulant and more people are paying attention because they're desperate to understand what's happening in their life. They're realizing how important government is in their life because it can literally take away their freedom and rope around their kids' playground and say, you're not going to work and I don't care if you starve. Here's $1,200. Like, the best the government can do for us is $1,200. Like, that's the, you know. So how does that guy get reelected? I don't know. But
because Joe Biden's running against him?
Because Joe Biden's running against him. And so, you know, Justin Amash will probably get into the race. He's signaling now that he's going to run as a Libertarian candidate. I think he probably gets the nomination. I think it depends on how many delegates, how we have a convention. I have no idea. But I think Justin Amash, if he gets in, may get it. Or Vermin Supreme's going to get it. The guy with the boot on his head's going to run.
I'm all about Vermin.
Man, I'll tell you, I just talked to him for the first time, and he's satire, and it's really satire. And when you – so I'm like, you know, if he gets it, maybe he becomes president and we all get our ponies. But I think
the boot doesn't go. He needs to keep the boot.
Yeah. So, again, it's like the Rupert thing. It's like, let Rupert be Rupert, let Trump be Trump, let Vermin be Vermin. But I don't know who wins the election, because Joe Biden is so weak and so fragile, and Donald Trump is also so weak and so fragile. And I don't know I just don't know where the electorate is at, because there is – it's sort of like – I really think that Donald Trump being president has kept us from slipping into civil unrest. Because you and I both know what our feeds look like. If Hillary Clinton were president right now, you'd know there'd be guns firing at this point. But they know that Donald Trump doesn't want to shut the economy down. He is going to reopen it. And so, you know, when the shit hits the fan for the right, he was there. He did all these Supreme Court justices that he wanted, you know? I think the Trump campaign is really solid. I think it's a really good campaign. It's way better than 2016. And I think they have no scruples. And Joe Biden has no idea what's coming his way. And he has no ability to fight it off at all. And so I think he gets reelected. I think it's all about voter turnout. And at the end of the day, and his base is so excited for him, and Joe Biden is not going to be able to make the case, and his base is not going to turn out.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a whole separate episode on this, because I got some theories that you could float about how turning the economies loose again and how that could affect reinfections, and how does that play out as we get closer to election day? How does that affect election day? I mean, you know, you have Republicans being like, you know, no, we should not do any sort of what was it? Mail-in ballots. And they're like, we had, you know, the Hamilton County clerk, our neighborhood association, sent out an email being like, the Hamilton County clerk is encouraging everyone to vote absentee for our primary. Everyone. But then you have Donald Trump and Kevin McCarthy and other Republican leaders being like, no, mail balloting is bad. It's ripe for fraud and all this. And I'm like, holy cow. If they're going to try to take away absentee balloting before the November election, I mean, what if we do have another spike in infections? You know, this isn't going away. I mean, in fact, everyone says that even if you open up the economies, even slowly, that the chances of this coming back are really good. And then what if it happens not necessarily before the election, but after the election? And let's say Biden wins or someone else wins. But in December, infections spike. And now you have a changing of the guard. You have in the middle of round two of a pandemic. Again, all these things. My wife and I.
Here is the scary part. Both sides are setting up the illegitimacy of the election.
Oh yeah.
The most chilling moment for me as a student of history was when Donald Trump stood in that debate with Clinton and said he wouldn't accept the results. And then what happened? Hillary Clinton didn't accept the results, and we've spent years on the Russian hoax, and it's delegitimized Trump's presidency, but the presidency itself, which, listen, I'm all about delegitimizing the government in people's minds, but slowly and in a way that replaces it with something that's thoughtful.
Yeah.
Then you add on Donald Trump setting the stage now for voter fraud. They're going to steal it with mail. And what if it's close? And what if he makes the claim that he's the legitimate president and he doesn't leave? Bill Maher was widely mocked for saying that a year ago, but it's a legitimate thought that people need to have. What happens when our president of the United States will not the solemn transferring, the peaceful transferring of power that Peter Jennings loves to drone on about or used to? What happens when that goes away? Because this is the man that will make that go away. So what you see in the fall of the Roman Empire, Mike Duncan wrote a great book called the Fall Before the Shadow, I don't remember. Look up Mike Duncan, but it's about the end of the Roman Empire. And Trump, my concern in 2015 with Trump is that he's the Gracchi. The Gracchi brothers came in. They grossly broke all of the political norms. You know, if you want to know what political norms were, think Richard Lugar. Well, everything that Richard Lugar was is gone. And everything that Richard Lugar was stability, which many libertarians, including myself, had many problems with the form of government that Richard Lugar believed in, but he was stability. Donald Trump is everything that is opposite of him, wants to break all of those norms. The Tea Party participated, the Murdochs of the world participated, and the Tea Party, and basically you have the prisoner's dilemma. After the Lewinsky situation, Democrats just said honor in politics no matter counts. And Republicans kind of said, yes, it does, yes, it does, yes, it does. And then when John McCain gets called a racist and Mitt Romney gets called a sexist and he's killing his dog on top of a car, I think Republicans made the calculation that we're not going to play your game anymore. Here's Donald Trump. And the danger of that is that you erase those political norms. And the way that the Gracchi brother brought in the agrarian reforms, and you know, they both were killed in the end, but they permanently broke the Republic in a way that could never be salvaged again. And that's my fear with this election. And I'm not going to say it's the most important of our election of our lifetime, because it doesn't matter which one of these two you elect. The virus is already in the system, and the only way to protect ourselves from the virus that both sides have unleashed is to just be a really decent person, decent to your neighbor, and as informed as possible. And, you know, so I think we're in very precarious waters. It's not guaranteed that we're going to go off the rails, but I think people need to be thinking about the next few months, because it could see the end of the American system when legitimacy breaks. And the American government doesn't deserve legitimacy, you know? So, and I'm one of those people that pushes that. I think that, you know, I'm concerned, and I just think it demands each of us to really think about what we amplify on social media, because it really counts.
Yeah. Well, we have been going on a lot longer than I anticipated, but that's good. It's been a great conversation.
I could talk for another hour.
I know you could. But I only have two more questions for you, and they're completely unrelated to this conversation at all.
Okay.
But for those of you who follow you or the We Are Libertarians account, especially on Instagram, you're known for memes. Mm-hmm. Some of the best memes. They are hilarious. They are liked by Republicans, independents, libertarians, Democrats alike, because
I just don't care. If I told you who was looking at my wall, you wouldn't believe it. I literally had one incredibly well-connected Republican come, like, I'm just the court jester of local politics, right? And when this person said that they sought out my Facebook page, not just for my thoughts, but also the memes, like, I laughed. Like, I couldn't believe that. Yeah, it is a weird thing that Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Independents—it's they all love memes.
Yeah, they do. So how does one become a meme god? I mean, you're known as Dear Leader within your circle.
Yeah, that came from So we had a co-host that I had to fire, and I just jokingly kind of diffused the tension. Said this is a dictatorship. We Are Libertarians is not representative government. I'm in charge, after I fired this person. And one of our co-hosts, Greg Lenz, started making memes of me, and, you know, through a few years ago, we all started kind of making memes of each other, and that really got a lot of attention for us. And at the time, it was seen as very juvenile and very stupid in 2014, 2015. But it got us a certain audience. And memes have just kind of become the political cartoon of the day. I have always loved Mad Magazine. I've always loved satire. Borat is my favorite movie. It's why, you know, when Vermin Supreme two nights ago explained his whole shtick to me, I went, I get it, and I kind of like it. You know, the tagline for We Are Libertarians has always been all of the irreverence modern politics deserves from day one. Mm-hmm. And humor is disarming. And we talk about serious things in a way where we don't take ourselves too seriously. And, you know, I've found that on my online audiences, if I give you the memes that are about the weird things that happen in life, or the stimulus check memes that everybody's relating to, or the Tiger King memes, then I can slip in the Christian quote, and I can slip in the libertarian memes, and I can slip in my podcast that I want you to listen to. And so, you know, some people want to be the libertarian on people's feeds, or they want to be the news source, or they want to be the weatherman. And what I've tried to do, because of my my job at Bob and Tom, which is a comedy show, We Are Libertarians, The Pat Down, which is a comedy show, you know, working with Robert Vane at Leaders and Legends, which is a great podcast that everyone should listen to, where we're talking to the establishment. Now hear this, where I'm talking to nonprofits. I have a lot of interests, and I don't want to pigeonhole myself into one thing. And I don't know if that's going to pay off long term in terms of positioning me as a media figure that can support myself. But the memes are the only thing that we have found that grows engagement, drives attention. That's what people want. They want to laugh. And there's only really three things that the internet is used for. It's you want to laugh, you want to look at things that result in certain bodily actions, and man, I used to say this all the time and made people, but there's really, like, that's it. Like, people just use the internet to laugh, shop, and for the other thing. And so, you know, people their minds aren't necessarily changed by a Facebook status. You can, over a long period of time, maybe convince some people and maybe get some people like yourself to think about a certain way, something a little fundamentally differently. But by and large, they're going to come and look at your audience for memes. You know, the being known as somebody who has quality memes, that's a hard skill to learn over time. Like, I've been trying to figure out what audiences want since 2002. Really, I mean, high school newspaper in 2000. So I've just dedicated myself to trying to figure out, all right, I know this thing is going to – I know at this point what's going to get a certain reaction. So, you know, it's there's a science to it, and it's just called good taste, and I can't teach that, Josh.
I guess not. You've been extremely talented, you and – I presume you have a crew that helps you with it as well. I mean, is it like do you have, like, in comedy, like a team of writers to do memes, or is it just something that you kind of, you can read the satire and the politics and just translate that into a quick meme?
A lot of the memes are not, I don't create a lot of the memes. I get sent a lot of memes. I see, follow the right people, and you find somebody that you know has good taste that makes you laugh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I follow some accounts, and I know, like, these are the good accounts, right? And, yeah, for like the personal memes that are just kind of like slice of life memes, that's those accounts that I follow, or people send me a lot of stuff now.
Yeah.
'Cause the reputation, but, which I love. I love when people send me memes and all that. With We Are Libertarians, we have about 40 people involved. It's gone on since 2012. That's when it was founded, March 8, 2012. And we've had probably 100 people over the 8 years involved in it. I have a research team. I have a meme team. You know, it's a collaborative effort. There's what is essentially a writer's room, where it's a running chat of about 20 co-hosts and participants in the network, where we just talk through the day, share our lives, build a little community, share memes, share stories, share thoughts, argue, you know, and that's been that running messenger has been a huge part of our success from 2013 on, you know, and it's what I do is I have a show where I'm the anchor, but I have other people participating. I have other co-hosts doing other shows. You know, it's a collaborative effort, and it's cross spectrum. I don't just try to push one version of how I think libertarian, you know, the Mises crowd, for instance, of the Mises Institute tries to push a certain attitude or type of libertarianism. I'm more agnostic about that. I want to represent everybody, you know. So relatability, I think, is the key. You know, if you are trying to build a media thing, you need people to be able to relate to your content. They need to see their lives in what you're saying and doing. And that's why memes are funny, because people look at that and go, ha, I do that with my butt too.
you laugh because it's true. Anyway. Okay, so I have this running thing on my show that, I mean, it's the political nomad. So if you're a nomad's travel, every good road trip deserves a good playlist. So what songs or artists or even comedians, because gosh, I mean, how long have you been working for Bob and Tom now?
6.5 years.
Wow. So you've come across a lot of comedians in your time, and especially in, I mean, now you got the podcast with Ms. Pat, which again everyone should check out, the Pat Down. If you're putting together your playlist for, I guess it could be for any road trip or for that you think would symbolize your political journey, you know, what songs, artists, or comedians do you think would be on that list?
George Carlin, number one.
I had a feeling you were going to say Carlin.
Yeah, Carlin, you know, look up Carlin's American Dream. It's a big club and you're not in it. I mean, that's just like... I have loved George. That was the first comedy, Class Clown. My mom had a record of it, and I memorized that album along with the Bill Cosby albums. But Carlin was just always, to me, so brilliant because he used humor and in a way that made you think about life in a different way. It was funny, but, you know, so Carlin, number one. I think he's great. I think Borat would, you know, just let's rip the audio of Borat, because I love Andy Kaufman is probably my favorite comedian. I love when people can't tell if you're serious or not. I think that is the highest compliment anyone can pay me, is I can't tell if you're serious or not. I love that. So, you know, anything Andy Kaufman or Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen is brilliant, and I love it. Because there's something humbling about prideful people when they're exposed by a satirist. So mm-hmm. I think that that's great. I would play the audiobook of William Manchester's audiobook about H.L. Mencken called Disturber of the Peace. It was originally called The Life and Riotous Times of H.L. Mencken. I think Mencken is probably the biggest influence in terms of my approach. He was always unpredictable. He was always funny. He was always sour. He was always – he just loved to – what he called stirring up the animals. He just loved to get people out of their comfort zone and think about things in a different way. And during World War I and World War II, he had to quit writing because he was – maybe a little too pro-German, which was acceptable in World War I, but less acceptable in World War II. But I think his approach was great. Music-wise, I am such an audio, like, podcast and talk radio and audiobook person.
What podcast would you recommend?
I would also say, like, anything by Dan Carlin is awesome. Hardcore History, that's amazing. Common Sense, even some of his older episodes. He has such a different way of thinking, and he really likes to make you think. I like The Daily by the New York Times. I think it's an innovative and fun way to look at the news. The Mike O'Meara Show, which is a comedy podcast, which is really what the biggest influence in terms of how I set up my show, because those guys are radio guys who created a comedy podcast that's really fun, because you got to have something that's just not too serious. Gosh, I'm trying to think about what other podcasts like are on my go-to. I listen to a lot of Ben Shapiro. Yes, I listen to Shapiro almost every day because Shapiro is very talented. I like Rush Limbaugh, and I listen to a lot of Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. I have always appreciated Glenn Beck's ability to stretch himself and do things in a creative way that are just totally different than anything anybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants to be Walt Disney, and in terms of conservative talk radio, he is. Limbaugh, from a skill perspective, if you want to do talk radio, he's the most skilled. Ben Shapiro can take what – if you're doing an hour on a podcast, you may get 1 to 3 subjects in that hour if you're disciplined. Shapiro can get 14 or 15 different topics covered in depth with really thoughtful, wow, insightful points of view, And so from a skill perspective, he's very talented. From an ideological perspective, he sometimes drives me nuts. But I find him very interesting. You know, of course, you got to put Joe Rogan on there because he always has a lot of interesting people that, that kind of make you think. And Dan Snow has a history podcast. I think it's called Dan Snow's History Hit. And I listen to that all the time. So a lot of history and a lot of wonk. I have 600 subscriptions on my podcast feed.
Holy cow.
And I don't obviously listen to all those. When I'm studying for a show and I put hours of research into every week of We Are Libertarians, I am perusing that, trying to find what think tank is talking about this, who's doing that kind of stuff. So, you know, and of course I'm going to get off here and I'm going to go, man, I should have mentioned that. But like I love No Agenda. No Agenda 2 it's a little more on the conspiratorial side, but those guys have such a great, their audience sends them tons of clips. They have a different way of thinking. So I guess that's sort of the playlist, is just like an alt playlist of news and information, and just I want you to think differently and approach life from an iconoclastic viewpoint, because I just find that more interesting. I think Tommy Lauren is the most boring person on the planet. You know, like, it's so predictable and boring. You tune into Tommy Lauren, or you tune into, you know, some of these nightly shows like MSNBC or Rachel Maddow. Like, Maddow at least is smart. Tucker Carlson, they're smart. Like, they have good information that backs it up, but they're interesting, and that's what I want. I want to be interested in what you're saying, because you're a little different, and you're not just like Sean Hannity is a hack. Like, there's nothing about what Sean Hannity does that is talent. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just predictable and boring.
Yeah. Well, I won't disagree with that, honestly. But personally, I've kind of had it with the 24-hour news crowd as it is.
Yeah.
But you know, it's hard to know where to go to get kind of what you're talking about. So I'm glad you provided some of these options, because I mean, you know, I look at my parents. They're not boomers. They're close to it, but they're not boomers. They were born during the war. But they eat and breathe Fox News.
Right.
You know, that's the be all end all for them. Anything else is fake news. And I get frustrated with that, because I look at Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. They all have agendas. So I don't want to watch something that is agenda driven. And so the news feeds or the news options seem to be so limiting, because everything seems to come with opinion added to it.
Yeah.
So I watch Reuters. Reuters has a great app, and you can watch 10, 15, 30 minute hits of news, and it's just reporting. That's it. Nothing else. And I can appreciate that, but sometimes I do want a little bit more context, but without the opinion, and that's what's difficult to get. So, but I think that, you know, looking at some of these gives you that opportunity to get that perspective, but also to have mixed perspective, so you're not just listening to one angle at the same time.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest concern, is listening to one angle at the same time.
Yeah, I'm kind of giving my, you know, some of my talk radio stuff here, but no, I think that to me, the left is establishment stuff. Like, I like a lot of the think tank podcasts, like, you know, AEI, the Council on Foreign Relations, Brookings. They have a bunch of great podcasts. Like, if you just look up, you know, Google American think tanks and go to any of these think tanks, they've all launched all kinds of stuff. You can find all the, you know, Cato Institute has – Reason Magazine has a lot of great podcasts too. I should add that to my playlist. You know, the Nick Gillespie interviews now, they've been really good, really insightful, always helpful. I just don't want my time wasted. And what I find with, like, these think tank, you know, I view things on a different spectrum. It's not left or right. Like, I can tune into The Weeds, which is a Vox podcast, and get some pretty much the same information in a more annoying way than I'll get from these think tank podcasts. Mm-hmm. But if I tune into No Agenda or Reason or Ben Shapiro, I'm probably going to get an opinion that is counter to what the major mainstream news outlets and the left and the institutions are saying. You know, so you kind of, there's always really just two arguments. There's not a ton of it, so if you're trying to help people decide, as what I see my role is helping people decide what is the better argument, what is the argument that is best, which usually happens to be the freest argument, that's how I kind of parse it out. I just want no nonsense news. I don't want to be manipulated, and I find Shapiro to be the most thoughtful and the least resistant to being manipulative of his audience, and so I can stomach him as a counterbalance. You know, Beck too. I think those two on the right give information in a way that is less manipulative. They have a point of view, but they're not like Rush Limbaugh, who does just try to go to bat for the president or circle the wagons. You know, I don't need that. I can turn on the news and watch Trump and hear him for himself. I know what the arguments are, but I think tanks are a great way to get a lot of good information from the left, from the right, from the libertarian perspective. So that's a good place to start too, because then you get policy and you're more informed in 15 minutes from listening to those than you are in 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow.
Absolutely agree. 100%. 100%. So with that, where can people find you, find We Are Libertarians, the network, everything? Where should they be looking to find some of your material, Chris?
Everything is at WeAreLibertarians.com. You can search We Are Libertarians on any platform where you listen to podcasts. We're there. You can search my name on any social media, Chris Spangle, and feel free to follow me. Send me messages. It's all good.
Great. Chris, thanks for being on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Glad you're doing it.
Yeah, thank you. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I ask that you subscribe and like this video. Please be sure to click the little bell to make sure that you get notifications every single time we upload a new video. And we will be having all this information in the show notes this week, so you can be sure to find links to all these podcasts and also the funny stuff from George Carlin and Andy Kaufman on the show notes. And I think that's about it. Well, this has been The Political Nomad. Thanks again to my guest this week, Chris Spangle. Have a good week.